Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau here on Wednesday, the 23rd of May, the year 2012. Jeff Brown's here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Mary Ann Ray about tourism in Juneau and also Pearson's Pond. Beth Weigel and Kathleen Blantic will educate us about the upcoming Outdoor Explorers Camp. And we'll hear some student podcasts with guest Christy Dillingham. That Writer's Almanac Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. For the forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with scattered rain showers this evening, patchy fog later on, low temperatures around 46 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, decreasing clouds with high temperatures around 61 degrees. Thursday night, partly cloudy skies with low temperatures around 44 degrees. And forecast Friday, increasing clouds with high temperatures around 58 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Eastern Shoshone tribe is challenging the Northern Arapaho tribe's federal lawsuit to pursue the right to kill bald eagles on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming. The tribes reside on the same reservation. Rebecca Martinez of Wyoming Public Radio reports.
This year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued a permit allowing the Northern Arapaho tribe to kill two bald eagles annually for religious purposes, as long as it does so outside the reservation it shares with the Eastern Shoshone. But because Wyoming law prohibits the killing of eagles on state land, the Northern Arapaho are suing Fish and Wildlife for the right to kill the eagles on the reservation. Kim Varalek, Attorney General for the Eastern Shoshone Tribe, says the tribes long ago established a joint law protecting eagles on the Wind River Reservation.
And for whatever reason, the Northern Arapaho Tribe's position is that they have enacted their own legal code and that it should somehow supersede that joint code, and we disagree.
Now the Eastern Shoshone tribe will participate in the federal suit as a friend of the court, hoping to uphold the Fish and Wildlife Permit's current status. Varalek says the Northern Arapaho should pursue an amendment through the tribal legislative process instead of going over the Shoshone's heads in federal court. She adds that it's unclear whether the eagle population on Wind River could support the taking of two eagles annually. Northern Arapaho tribal attorney Andy Baldwin wrote in an email that the joint tribal code protects freedom of religious expression, as does the U.S. Constitution. For National Native News, I'm Rebecca Martinez in Laramie.
In honor of the British Queen's Diamond Jubilee year, the Prince of Wales and his wife are on a four-day visit to Canada. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the whirlwind tour included a meeting in Toronto with some First Nations leaders.
Aboriginal leaders are among the first to say they have a special relationship with the British Crown. It's one that stretches back and was strengthened in the 18th century with the royal document called the Royal Declaration of 1763. Many consider it a Bill of Rights for Indigenous people in Canada. In that document, King George III recognized that First Nations had rights to the lands they occupied, and he promised they would be protected. That promise continues in other documents, such as the Constitution Act and rulings by the Supreme Court of Canada. Prince Charles, also known as Red Crow, has already been made a ceremonial chief by the Blood Tribe of Alberta. Some native leaders met with the prince while he was in Toronto. Among them was Ovid Mercredi, a former national chief of the Assembly of First Nations.
We made a request today to have the Queen receive us, all the chiefs of Canada, to deal with treaties with the Crown in October 7th, 2013, which is the anniversary of the Royal Proclamation of 1763.
Mercredi says the chiefs want to discuss why Canada has not honored treaties in the years since the proclamation was signed. Charles agreed to pass the request on to the Queen. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia upholds the final settlement in the historic Indian Trust lawsuit filed by the late Eloise Cobell. The class action lawsuit was filed more than a decade ago over the government's mishandling of individual trust accounts for 500,000 Indians. The decision released Tuesday rejected the appeal of challengers, which has delayed disbursement of the more than $3 billion settlement. On this day in 1923, Navajo code talker Alfred Frank Leonard was born in Lukachukai, Arizona. Leonard was one of the original 29 Navajo code talkers who created an unbreakable code that was used during World War II. Leonard passed away in 1999. The Navajo Code Talkers were silent heroes for 60 years before they were officially recognized with congressional medals in 2001. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
I'm Billy Mills. As a grandfather and Olympic athlete, I know the importance of keeping kids healthy. The Children's Health Insurance Program in your state can provide your child additional health coverage, such as dental care, vision care, and emergency services. Enrolling your child can also help maximize health resources at your travel clinic. To learn more, contact your clinic or call 1-877-KIDS-NOW or visit insurekidsnow.gov.
Sponsored by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest is Marianne Ray, who's along with her daughter Rachel Ray, own Pearson's Pond and beautiful out the road Juneau, right by the glacier. Marianne, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. I appreciate it.
So before we get into the interview, talking about a little bit about tourism and bed and breakfast in Juneau in general, how did you move it to Juneau?
Well, 3 years ago, I came on a vacation. I brought my family on a cruise up to Anchorage, and we flew back because I wanted to spend a lot of time in Juneau. We spent a couple weeks in Juneau. We stayed at Pearson's Pond, and in talking to Diane Pearson, found out that they were looking to retire and were wanting to sell the inn. And I had retired from my job about a year before and was looking for something else to do. I knew I wanted to move to Juneau. I don't think the opportunity could have been any better. We're so happy we made the change.
That was 3 years ago.
3 years ago. Almost exactly, July of 2009.
What did you find out? What do you know now that you didn't know before?
Well, I've always known how beautiful Juneau is. It was the main reason to want to come here. What I've really learned a lot about since I've been here, obviously because of the inn, is tourism and how important tourism is to the city of Juneau. As I was thinking about that on the way in the car, I realized, you know, things are kind of complementary here, it's not through any design, it's just by the way it works out. But from a tourism perspective or an innkeeper's perspective, we have the government session, then we have the tourist season, and then we have the fall, which kind of gives us a chance to sort of regroup and spend some time with family, which we don't get a lot of time the rest of the year to do. So it just really works out well for somebody in the tourism business, I think.
And you brought some statistics with you.
I did. I don't know how many people out there understand that how important Juneau is to tourism is to Juneau. Tourism is 13% of the Juneau economy. And other than the state of Alaska, tourism has the most jobs in the area. So it's really very important. And clearly people come up here for the scenery and the wildlife and the activities. And most of us, when we think of tourism, we think of the cruise ships coming in, and they do certainly bring thousands of people every year. But the part of the tourism business that I'm most involved with is the independent traveler, the people who come to Juneau because they want to stay in Juneau for a while. They usually stay at our inn. Well, we like to think they usually stay at our inn. There are many bed and breakfasts and hotels in the area, and they stay at all of them. But it's the independent traveler that really comes up and wants to stay a while that is mostly my concern. So the cruise ships are very important because they bring so many people up here. About 20% of the folks who come up on cruise ships actually plan another trip to come back to Juneau at a later date and stay as an independent traveler. And that's the group that's really the most important to the Juneau economy, are the independent travelers.
So all people who stay at Pearson's Pond to expect to see a bear when they wake up in the morning?
Well, maybe not every day, but we do have our little neighborhood bear out there. Her name is Cinnamon. And she has a couple of three-year-old cubs now. So it looks like every now and then we do see her wandering back along the side of the property at where the blueberry bushes are. She'll come across, and they aren't in yet, so it's a little early, but she'll come across when the blueberries are there and just swipe them off the bushes and work her way down the property to the street. cross the parking lot, go over to the pond, get a drink of water, and head off to another set of blueberry bushes down the way.
After took all the blueberries.
Yes, they love the blueberries.
You have about some figures about finances and how much people bring and those people spend when they come to Juneau.
Yeah, the average person, independent traveler in Juneau, spends over $500 per visit. So that includes, and many of them will stay multiple days and spend much more than that. So they're very important to our economy because they not only do they bring us money and jobs, but they also keep us pretty vibrant and let us know how lucky we are to be living in such a beautiful place.
But how many breakfasts are there in Alaska? Do you have any idea?
I really don't know. I would guess maybe 200, I would guess, in the entire state. But that's really just a swag on my part.
How do you describe a typical bed and breakfast? How many units?
Well, actually, the one thing I wouldn't do is describe anyone as a typical bed and breakfast because there's such a huge range in what they can be like. Anything from someone who has an extra room in their home who provides breakfast to a guest to something like a small boutique hotel, which is very much like Pearson's Pond is, where it's a little more, the rooms are a little more private. And there's a formal lobby. Everybody has a sitting area in their room, while there's a common area where they can gather in the main room. There's just a little more separation. Certainly you have shared bathrooms in some bed and breakfasts, all the way up to no shared bathroom where you have your individual breakfast or individual bathroom. We also have, in Juneau, I know, several homes that have outside houses that have been set up really nicely for independent travelers. So there's several really very beautiful properties here in Juneau.
And this is probably the wrong question to ask, since there's no such thing as a typical bed and breakfast, but is there such a thing as a typical day at a bed and breakfast?
I think there's probably pretty much. I mean, with the bed and breakfast, there are a few things that you can count on. One is breakfast. So every morning there's breakfast. The second is cleaning. Every day there's cleaning. And the third is laundry, and that's never done. So we get up in the morning. We make a nice breakfast for our guests. We clean up after that. We have a little bit of a lull in the early afternoon, and then it's time to make snacks as we're doing our housekeeping. And in the evening, we put out wine and cheese. We don't do dinner at our inn. Some of them do, but we don't.
Tell me about the Diamond rating system.
Well, AAA does a really thorough, an unbelievably thorough job, detailed review of every property that they analyze. And they actually send people to the property with a five-page list of single-line points that they review. There's a set of points for a room. There's a set of points for the lobby, for the kitchen, for the grounds. They're very thorough in what they do. They look for cleanliness. They look for amenities. They look for decor. They look for service, and they look for the hospitality. And they make their assessment based on what their point scale is. It's an overall average of the place, but they never give you anything lower or higher than the lowest mark that you get. So it's a very, very – they send somebody out once a year. Every year we have a mystery shopper, and every year we have a – introduced assessor. So the introduced assessor will come out and tell us when they're there, hi, I'm from AAA. And then we'll take them on a tour of the property, and they'll look at how everything is as at that moment, and they will give us an assessment at that moment based on what they see. And then the mystery shopper will come back, and we won't know they're coming. They'll make a reservation. They'll stay two or three nights, and they'll sample the goods. You know, they'll have the breakfast. They'll see how we keep up the room. They'll make sure that the amenities that we say we're offering are actually being offered, those kinds of things. And after they leave, sometimes they'll come back and say, great job. Sometimes we never hear from them again. But every year when we get that four diamond, we know that we did well.
You mean the only four diamond in Alaska?
We are still the only four diamond in Alaska.
And you just finished a remodel.
We did. We did. We remodeled our common areas. We put in slate flooring, new paint, reupholstered the furniture, put in new carpeting. It really is different. For those of you who haven't seen it, since the remodel and you remember it from before, you ought to just come by and take a look. It really looks beautiful.
And I understand you have special rates for locals?
We do, especially this summer. Because of the remodel, we want our friends here in town to have a chance to come out and see it. So what we're doing for locals right now is letting them come out at winter rates. If they call us, it has to be a quick turnaround type of a visit. So if they call us the day they want to come out or the day before, we'll let them stay at the winter rate instead of the summer rate, which is quite a savings. That's a huge savings.
And what's your maximum occupancy?
You mean how many people can we have? We can have about 15 is the most that we really think is comfortable there.
Is including the hot tubs?
Yeah, but all 15 can't be in the hot tub at the same time. We have two hot tubs.
If people need more information about Pearson's Pond, how could they find it out?
Oh, they can call me. They can call me at 789-3772. I'm happy to talk about it. I love talking to locals. I like making new friends. So we consider this part of our friendship making.
Well, you consider several ways that locals could help maintain the level of tourism that we have now.
I think it's just really important for everybody who lives in Juneau to realize that each individual here is an ambassador. And actually, it's easy, I think, for most Juneauites to be able to do that, because my experience here has been that people are friendly and they're helpful and they are nice, which is, you know, much better than can be said for many places down south. So people are often surprised up here at how nice people can be, and that's very important. We want them to feel welcome. We want them to come back. So if you see a stranger out there who looks lost, ask them if you can help and point them in the right direction. They'll appreciate it. They'll tell their friends, and we'll have more people coming back to visit us.
Marianne Ray, thank you for visiting us on a Juneau afternoon today. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, you were very thorough as usual, Jeff. I appreciate being here. Thank you very much for having me.
We're grateful. We eat a big plate and smile right after breakfast. We're
Aldar. The time is 3:19, 3:20, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on the Juneau afternoon. Next guests are here to talk about Discovery Southeast and the Outdoor Explorer Camp. I'll let Beth Weigel introduce our guests. Beth, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Jeff. It's great to be here. I brought with me today Christine Amor. She's our AmeriCorps member. She's been here with me lots this year talking about different things. And then our very newest intern, Kirsten Wilbur. She just arrived yesterday, and she's going to be our assistant for our Outdoor Explorers program this summer, our day camp for 7 to 12-year-olds. So Kirsten is here she's from Wasilla, and so tell us a little bit about how you ended up in this intern position.
Yeah, well, I'm down at Northern Arizona University studying environmental science, but I'm originally from Wasilla, so I'm happy to be back in Alaska for the summer teaching kids about nature. I'm really excited, and yeah, I'm going to be the Alaska Conservation Foundation intern working as the assistant naturalist for Discovery Southeast this summer, basically running the Outdoor Explorers Day Camp. And yeah, we got a bunch of fun stuff coming up for the summer. We have a new theme this year called Glacier Goonies. That's going to be our first camp.
Glacier what? Goonies?
Glacier Goonies, yes. It's going to be our camp that's focused on glaciers and how they shape the landscape and all about glaciers, and that's going to be June 11th through 15th.
First week of camp.
Yeah, yep. First week.
So I know what a glacier is, but what is a glacier goonie?
Did you ever see the movie The Goonies? They were really cool kids who all went out exploring and found all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah, so that's what we're hoping, that these kids can have a lot of fun with it and, go explore the glaciers themselves. And then, our second week of camp, June 18th through 22nd, is the Marine Scene Week. So we're going to talk about sea life and sea critters and all kinds of fun sea life.
And isn't there a pretty good low tide that week?
I think so. Yeah, we tried to plan them. We tried to plan our weeks around kind of the good tide weeks and plan around natural calendar.
So right now there's still a good bit of room in those first 2 weeks, but we have had a lot of the weeks for Outdoor Explorers, which there's 9 weeks over the course of the summer, and we've had a couple of weeks. 1 week is actually full, and a couple other weeks have only a couple spots left, so things fill up, and we want to make sure everybody knows how to get their 7 to 9 or 10 to 12-year-old enrolled in our Outdoor Explorers camp and be able to go on all these great adventures with Kirsten and our other leader, who's Megan Bush, who's a local woman who will be running the program along with Kirsten this summer.
And our older kids camps for kids ages 10 through 12 are going to be really cool this year. We're going to have a Wilderness Adventurers Week July 2nd through 6th, actually, talking about backcountry skills, orienteering, and we're actually going to be rafting the Mendenhall River. And then the Alpine Explorers Week is going to be July 30th through August 3rd, and that's also for older kids, ages 10 through 12, and we're going to be focusing on the Alpine Tundra, so a lot of bigger hikes and checking out all the fun stuff up on the tundra.
Can you sign up for just like 1 week at a time, or do you have to do all the multi-week experience?
No, you can sign up for just 1 week at a time, and we actually sort of limit kids to 2 weeks initially, and then if there's room in other weeks when we get closer, then we let them sign up for more. But we want to give all the kids in Juneau the opportunity to register for the Outdoor Explorers camps. And one of the fun activities that we also have planned for Outdoor Explorers this summer is bringing back the Parade of Species. Last year we did our first annual ever Parade of Species in the 4th of July parade, and kids dressed up as their favorite species, and we also constructed some costumes in the Outdoor Explorers first few weeks there, and it's going to be a fun entry into the parade again. It's a great way to participate, and Christine's actually going to be heading up some workshops at the Canvas in June to get people inspired and get them thinking about some cool costumes, as well as what we're going to be constructing as our feature costumes. So maybe you could tell them a little bit about that, Christine.
Yeah, so we're actually going to start things off June 9th in celebration of World Ocean Day. So June 8th is actually World Ocean Day. Therefore, we're going to celebrate the 9th. That's a Saturday from 10 to 1 at the Canvas, and our theme will be marine life. So we are focusing on making costumes of different marine species. And then our second canvas event will be at the end of the month, so right before the parade, really, June 30th, from 10 to 1, and our focus will be more on birds. So this year's parade theme is actually red, white, and blue, so we're focusing on creating different birds like, you know, herons, jays, gulls, red-breasted sapsuckers, all red, white, and blue birds, and then we'll do some more intertidal creatures, which, you know, we can do different color, red, white, and blue, sea stars. We'll do some, you know, barnacles and
jellyfish.
Yeah, so lots of different red, white, and blue things we can think of in the intertidal zone.
As well as maybe just some fish.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just some random stuff. So fish, so salmon, rockfish, halibut. And then our feature species, Beth, maybe you want to tell them about our humpback whale idea.
Well, it's my crusade this year to try and create a humpback whale that's, you know, calf size, so 25 feet approximately in length, and we want to have that ready for the parade.
What do you could construct it out of?
Well, the idea is if you think about, you know, how we have the sort of the Chinese dragon sort of model, so some sort of a structure maybe with PVC pipes and some sort of like material that covers that. So it's very lightweight, almost like a kite or something, is what I'm envisioning. So that's what we've got a little bit of a plan for. And we also are trying to, you know, involve any businesses who want to sponsor any of our species. So, you know, if you're interested in getting your logo seen in the parade or, you know, being a part of that in that way, then we can certainly tell you all about how you can sponsor a species in the parade as well.
Sounds like a lot of activities going on with Discovery Southeast.
Yeah, so it's going to be a fun summer, and we're ready for the weather to change and get ready for our Outdoor Explorers camps that start on June 11th, and we'll be preparing for the 4th of July parade all throughout June with these great canvas workshops at the canvas and also during our Outdoor Explorers, and then camp is going to be great this summer.
If people need more information, is there a phone number they can call or a website?
Absolutely. Our phone number at the office is 463-1500. Our website is www.discoverysoutheast. It's all one word, all spelled out, .org. And there's information about both our Outdoor Explorers Camp as well as the Parade of Species on our website. And we're there pretty much every day. Somebody's around to take your call and talk to you or register your child for camp. And it's going to be, like I said, a fun summer.
And thank you for coming down. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Maybe I could add one thing. Just for anyone who's listening who has a brainstorm right away, any old gear or old sort of craft supplies, materials that you can think of that we could use to make our creatures, please just call the office. Let us know. We would appreciate anything, really.
Right, like
fabric.
Used or old umbrellas and fabric and things like that, yeah.
And number again is 463-1500.
463-1500.
All right. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you. Jeff.
Thank you.
Grass a growing and hear the sleeping fox. He could hear the clouds a passing and the song of the morning dew. And if you start to listen, yes, you can hear them too. Oh, you don't need ears to listen if your mind is open too. There's all this life and living that is all a part of you. You can listen with your eyes, you can listen with your nose, you can even listen with your big nose. I once knew a woman, and her ears were going bad, but she knew how to listen, so I wasn't quite so sad. She could hear the flowers open and hear the desert sing. And if you start
to listen, you can hear most anything. Oh, you don't need ears to listen if your mind is open to. There's all this life and living, and it's all a part of you. You can listen with your eyes, you can listen with your toes. You can even listen with your big nose.
Is Bird Note. This strange sound is a male ruddy duck performing his bubbling display. When the sexes meet on the breeding grounds, usually a warm, weedy lake in the western interior, the males of these pudgy little ducks get right to strutting their stuff. When a female appears, the male raises his long tail and his head, with feathers on it that look like horns. He inflates his neck and faster strikes his chest with his bill. These blows force air through the feathers, causing the water to bubble. The male's display ends with his head and tail jerking forward and a low belching sound. Whenever you hear this, watch for a bright rufous red duck with black and white head and sky blue bill. After the bubbling display, the male will usually run across the water with rapidly beating wings, his feet putt-putting like a little motorboat. Stay by the water, and you'll hear this motorboat alternating with the bubbling display again and again. One of the ruddy duck's many delightful qualities is that it can make you laugh out loud. You can watch a video of a ruddy duck's courtship display when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Time is 3:33 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest here to talk about podcasts done by students, Christy Dillingham and also Wesley McKeown. Thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
We're excited
to be here today.
So describe what we're really going to be listening to in general, if you could please.
Well, the CARES program, which is a Juneau School District credit recovery program, just recently offered a botany intensive class that students took for a biology credit. And the students studied botany through the lens of how plants impact the quality of our lives, past, present, and future. And so what the students did was they took all that information they gained, and each student chose a particular topic to create a podcast and to share that podcast.
Leslie, you want to tell me about the process in general?
The process we used, we had been advised by Riley Woodford, and he's an in-town gentleman, I think, who does many podcasts daily that everyone listens to, and he gave us a lot of advice. And he told us the processes and the programs that he used. And he gave us a lot of good information about how we can work on them, how we should talk, just in general, how the general structure of podcasts on the radio were. And it was a really good template for us to start using them. And we recorded them in class with the computers the school provided us with on GarageBand and got them finished in about 2 to 3 days each.
What did you learn?
I learned mainly about my topic, but when it came to podcasts, I learned how to speak and a lot of program stuff regarding radio. And, of course, I can't say I'm a professional radio person now, but we learned a lot about how the podcasts have to be at least like 90 seconds and everything like that. And as regarding to the botany part, we learned so much that we learned culture, we learned science, we learned our own individual topics specifically, and then we were able to share those with our other students and the crowd, and it was a great experience.
And we're going to be listening to about 10 podcasts this afternoon on the show, so you want to describe what we're going to be listening to?
Sure. We've got about 9 podcasts. Each of the podcasts was put together by each student. The students were given the opportunity to choose their topic. And so some of those topics that you'll hear in these podcasts are about invasive plants, about Devil's Club, about genetically modified plants, different poisonous plants, hydroponics, biomass and energy. And again, all of these are through the lens of how do plants affect the quality of our lives, past, present, and future.
Let's listen to them.
It was a nice, bright, sunny day in the field. The sweet aroma of my family and friends all around me as we swayed in a slow, cool breeze. The sunlight beating down on me, making the condensation of our leaves glisten and sparkle. Then it hit me, a new figure far on the horizon. Deciding not to think anything of this new figure, I go about my perfect day. Soon enough, though, I look again at the new figure, and I notice that it's not only affect one figure anymore, but multiple. Even as I watch this new mystery appearance, more and more start appearing all around me. I start to worry as these invaders make their way closer and closer to me. Not only are they moving closer, but I also start feeling weaker and weaker by the moment, like something is sapping my energy. And water, oh, how ever so thirsty have I been, and it was only just a few moments ago when I was last watered. This is a short story of how I imagine a plant must feel towards invading invasive species. This species that was invading in particular is called the orange hawkweed, which is a very common species that crowds up the plants and kills them, and is one of many invasive species around Alaska. Now you're probably asking yourself questions like, why does this matter to me? What is the whole point of this? Well, think of it this way. Let us say that you have a new large vegetable garden and that you plan to start growing veggies and plants. Then, one day, you notice a new plant in or around your garden. You think nothing of it, but pull it and forget about it. But not even a week later, you have 10 to 20 more plants that spread even further in your garden and start sapping the much-needed nutrients and water from your veggies. And from here, before you know it, your garden will be completely taken over from such invasive plants. This does not only happen to your garden, but also to your flower beds and the forest that surround your house. This is why the story matters to you. My name is Tristan Wasik. Thank you for listening to my podcast, story, and lecture. If you have more questions about invasive species in Juneau, go to junoinvasive.com.
One spring morning, a female bear emerged from her den for the first time of the year. But she was not alone. Trotting clumsily behind her was a new cub. As the cub grew stronger, he decided to venture off on his own for the first time. He went to an area of the forest that was really swampy and wet and squishy. While he was playing, he saw a giant green-leaved plant with a yellow flower in the center. As he got closer to the plant, he noticed a really bad smell. But he still got closer to the plant, not knowing where the smell was coming from. When he finally reached the plant, he took a deep breath, thinking that the plant would smell just as good as all the others he had seen. But to his surprise, the plant was the worst-smelling thing he had ever smelled in his short little life. He quickly ran back home to his mom to ask what the smelly new plant was. When he got home, his mom told him that the smell came from a really important plant called skunk cabbage. She told him that even though skunk cabbage has many good uses, it could also be a dangerous plant. She told him about the oxidized crystals that were found in the juices of skunk cabbage and how they could cause rashes on humans wherever their juices touched, and how if they got any of the juices into their mouths, it could feel like they were swallowing glass. The bear cub looked at his mom with eyes that were as big as robin's eggs, filled with fright. When she noticed how scared he was, she told him about how skunk cabbage could be used as medicine by telling him the story of the bear that got injured by some hunters. The bear went into the woods to find the skunk cabbage, and when he did, he chewed up the leaves of skunk cabbage until it was like a paste and spread the cabbage onto his wound to stop the bleeding and to help the wound heal. The cub's face started to look a little happier, but she could tell that he was still afraid of the plant. So she went on to tell him how the roots of skunk cabbage could be dried and put into a tea that is safe to drink. The mom noticed that when she talked about food, her cub started to look even happier. So she decided to tell him about her favorite use for the plant. She told him how you could wrap a salmon up in skunk cabbage and cook it in the salmon pit. She told him that you have to be careful when you do this, though, because if you do not cook it long enough, the juices will still hurt you. After she told her cub this, his face lit up, and he asked if they can go fishing. He couldn't wait to try cooking the salmon and skunk cabbage. This story was written by Cora Danielson, a 2012 CARES Biology Intensive student.
Hi, my name is Keenan De La Rosa, and I'm here to talk to you about genetically modified plants as part of the CARES Plant Podcast series. Imagine yourself at the grocery store or your local supermarket about to bite into the juiciest apple you've ever seen. The crisp, gleaming red skin just calling your name. You munch into it and savor the sweet, sorbent, succulent skin. Something doesn't feel right though. At first, it's just a tickle at the back of your throat. You look at the apple as your airway starts to seize up. You're having an allergic reaction. The reason you were allergic to the apple was because it was genetically modified. Scientists can alter a fruit or vegetable's genetic makeup so it produces more and tastes better, but doing this requires introducing a foreign gene. These introduced genes can come from another plant, insect, or even bacteria. Do you know why scientists would change the genes of a plant? Genetically modified plants, also called GMO plants, are created by big businesses to make the most profit for the least cost. They are hard to predict and not regulated by our government. Also, you can easily see how some foreign genes can harm people with certain allergies. Now some good stuff about GMO plants. The high yield and bigger crops could mean less hunger and less shortages of food. They could also introduce plants to new climates. European governments require labels for all food products that use GMOs, while in the U.S., over 70% of the processed foods contain ingredients that have been injected with foreign genes. Remember, always know what you're eating.
My name is Zach Easton, and I am a CARES student taking a botany class. I was told to find a plant for a science project, and instantly my mind traveled to death. I wonder what plants grew around my home, do you know, that were poisonous? Even though one doesn't usually want to go looking for things that could kill them, I think it's a good idea to be able to identify deadly plants while I'm out fly fishing in remote southeast Alaska locations. My friend and I flipped through the poisonous plant book trying to one-up each other by finding plants that cause the most excruciating symptoms. As I was laying on the floor and munching on a crunchy, honey-flavored Nutrigrain bar and sipping on steaming lemon ginger tea, flipping through the poisonous plant section of my textbook, I found a plant called false hellebore. False hellebore is a fatally poisonous plant from sprouting until it dies. The roots are 10 times as toxic as the plant's leaves and stem. It can grow to be 3 to 8 feet tall. This hellish plant's leaves grow much like a skunk cabbage, big and soft, but they grow a stalk with a wispy white flowers on it, unlike the yellow flowers of the skunk cabbage, and the veins run parallel versus the skunk cabbage's netted leaves. From ingesting any part of the false hellebore, you will start salivating, vomiting, abdominal pain, muscular weakness, general paralysis, fast irregular heartbeats, and possibly coma. These will start between 2 and 3 hours after ingesting, according to the Wild, Edible, and Poisonous Plants of Alaska, published by the UAF Cooperative Extension. The reason false hellebore is so poisonous is because it has many toxic alkaloids. False hellebore is a common plant around southeast Alaska, and according to Discovering Wild Plants by Janice Schofield, has been used by native tribes for generations. In times of war, they would give roots to prisoners of war from other tribes to test their strength. If the prisoner survived, he was deemed strong enough to be adopted by the tribe. Next time you're out fly fishing or walking around the forest near a riverbank, be careful and keep an eye out for the false hellebore. and never eat anything that you are not sure about in the wild. It just might be false hellebore.
Hello, my name is Tim Wilson, and I am a sophomore at JDHS. I am currently enrolled in a credit recovery program called CARES that takes place at YDHS. This time, it is a biology class called Botany, which is the study of plants. In Southeast Alaska, you often see a type of fungi on both live and dead trees called bear bread. Bear bread is edible, but not by bears. It is a shelf species of conch fungi. There are several of these species in Southeast Alaska. The fungi inhabits the shady side of the tree, which prevents it from fatally drying out in the sun. A healthy conch has the texture of an earthworm, smooth and moist. The sporing bodies are what you actually see, but the actual conchs are all connected inside the trunk and are very resilient to force. When struck, it should produce this hollow, woody sound like a 2x4 hitting a rock. The skin color usually varies, but is usually dark brown to tan on the top and white or a light brown on the other side, but the top is universally darker. The underside is smooth, but the tops are often wrinkled or rigid and can resemble a bulldog at a distance, which I had as a kid. They are more commonly fond of deciduous trees, but they are hardy and do as well in coniferous trees as the other. The conch fungi are not edible because it is very dense and would be a real toothache if you even tried. They have many other uses. When dried, they are a substitute for tinder. When ground, they cure stomach bugs and are broken off and painted off, allowing a freestanding piece of art that doubles as a bookend. I learned quite a lot in both this CARES class and about bear bread. And this is a good example of what catches our eye is not really what we think.
Hello, my name is Eli Davis, I'm a CARES student, and I'm doing a podcast. A little mouse is rummaging across the forest floor. The pitter-patter of his little feet moved carefully through the thick forest, and the breeze made a gentle whoosh through the tree's leaves. The mouse's stomach had been bothering him with pain, and there had been no solution to him rummaging through the forest plants. Suddenly, he could smell a pleasant mint scent nearby. It was field mint. He nibbled it to cure his hunger, and as the active substance in the leaf, called etheric oil, eased down to his belly, he felt at ease and squeaked in relief. Just like this little mouse, people in Alaska use field mint and tea to relieve their stomach pain, otherwise known as wild mint, pole mint, Indian mint, or brook mint. This Alaska mint grows in the southeast, western, and interior Alaska in preferably damp, shady areas. Mint is a fantastic plant. It's used medicinally, therapeutically, in teas, toothpaste, gum, and candy flavorings, recipes involving soups and desserts, and even as a natural alternative to deodorant. This plant is used medicinally, typically relieving pains in the stomach or head, digestive problems, or for sinus and chest congestion. Mint is a frequently used plant in our modern lives.
Hello there, my name is Wes, and this podcast on hydroponics was created during the CARES Intensive Biology Recovery Program. The podcast depicts a fiction possible reality in the near future in a city called Townsville. The title of this presentation is called Technology of Townsville. The City of Townsville, a vast metropolis of industry and innovation. So advanced and so productive that all the land is cultivated for industry and the future. Within Townsville's titanic towers, there are no farms and soil, but the smells of meat and the sounds of oil. Townsville had no fruit to feed its white-collared pen pushers, not a sign of a vegetable within any of its vast production warehouses. Our people have grown corpulent and lazy within the last couple years. At this rate, our own children will grow up unhealthy, I fear. It was the mayor of Townsville found pacing in his office. he's been at the head of a very aggressive push to find an alternative method to grow fruit and vegetables for Townsville's ever-growing population. We've gone over our options with our mayor, and hydroponics has been our main focus in our war on malnutrition. Our populace getting lethargic and large is a concern, but it's only a small concern compared to how many people are not fulfilling their daily requirements of vitamins and nutrients. Our mayor has provided us with facilities to grow indoor fields with a very high rate of success. A huge advantage to our program is taking our slums and turning them into learning centers for our younger generations and for production of non-profit and meaningful agriculture. Also, with all the fruit and vegetables, citizens don't have to spend large sums of cash on supplemental vitamins and can get used to eating healthier. This was Professor Plutonium, the head of the program. This matter means a lot to citizens such as Plutonium, who like him have a new generation of children to take care of. With hydroponics, Townsville can take much of its waste, such as brick shards, for example, and turn it into a non-soil medium fertilizer to grow their plants indoors. With all of the businesses, there are plenty of warehouses that were available for the city to use for growing their new gardens indoors. With hydroponics, none of the water and resources for the plants go to waste by seeping into the soil and dehydrating. Townsville has adapted a run-to-waste system of hydroponics where they can use mediums such as sand and brick shards to apply water to the surface. Nutrient-rich water is applied upon the surface and runs down to the roots. It is then held in a layer of liquid that the roots can absorb. The sand does not absorb the water and nutrients, so none of it goes to waste. As the fruits of our labor of people such as Plutoniums begin to show in our supermarkets and restaurants, it's already making a huge impact on the health-conscious community of Townsville. As the elderly begin to grow stronger, the youngest of our children learn to enjoy their healthy lifestyle, and our youngest and brightest minds continue to teach us more and more about our health needs, we can all breathe a sigh of relief as the world of industry discovers how important the world of our bodies begin to change for the future. Thank you.
Dennis Algarve, one of many students determined to graduate high school and earn a diploma. Through an after-school program called CARES, I enrolled in a biology intensive class. We had left Marie Drake at 8 a.m. on a Saturday to plant potatoes. Excited? No. It was cold and windy at the Jensen Olsen Arboretum when I stepped out of the vehicle and walked towards the small house, gathering in a circle, surrounded by classmates, teachers, one being the Clinkett elder, Helen Watkins. I could not believe I had to deal with manure on a Saturday before planting potatoes. I was thinking, well, better just get it over with. We had to spread cow manure out and made it tender by using a spade and crumpling up huge chunks with our hands. Thank God I had gloves. However, as we began to plant potatoes, my negative emotions were swept aside and quickly shifted to focusing on becoming a collaborative team member. Working with other students to prepare the ground for Marie's potato, a Clinkett potato, which is closely related to the Rosette potato from Washington and the Cassan from the Prince of Wales Island. It was also genetically related to potatoes found in Chile and Mexico. I have learned that these potatoes do not rot easily because they are adapted to our Southeast Alaska cold and wet environment. As I worked with my hands crushing the manure, I began to have fun. I had never planted potatoes in my life. This was something totally new for me. For some reason, planting has become personally emotional, especially after being convinced by Helen that plants also have a living essence. She talked about how she ask plants to grow taller or bloom and grow flowers. I had a wonderful time at the Jensen Olsen Arboretum. It was a great experience, and I encourage people to see how potatoes have grown in a couple of months. The Jensen Olsen Arboretum is free and open Wednesday to Sunday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
My name is Adrian Lamas, brought to you from the CARES Botany class with Raya Waldron. And I will be talking to you about biomass energy and the difference between renewable and regular biomass. Biomass energy sources will play an important role in the world's future. And the energy sources have been split into three categories. Those are fossil fuels, renewable sources, and nuclear sources. The fossil fuels are coal, oil, and natural gases. As for renewable sources, that would include solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, and hydropower. Solar energy is the energy that we get from the sun. It is a major source of energy among every nation in the world because it helps make our crops and plants grow to give us heat, food, resources, and much, much more. The world's energy markets rely heavily on the fossil fuels, such as coal, crude oil, and natural gases, as source of energy. Since millions of years are required to form fossil fuels in the earth, these biomass fuels are not renewable. Biomass energy is all non-fossil organic materials that can be used as fuel. They include all water and land-based vegetation, for example, trees. And all biomass waste, such as solid waste, municipal biosolids, also known as sewage, is biomass energy. While biomass is renewable in the sense that only a short period of time is needed to replace what is used as an energy resource, so we can use and make it time and time again. The next time you're standing outside, sweat pouring down your face, and feeling the swift but gentle breeze cooling you off, chopping away your summer chores, collecting wood for long and cold winter nights, for winter is just around the corner. Then when winter comes, you find yourself sitting by your warm stove-top fireplace, enjoying your favorite cup of tea, forgetting all your troubles, knowing that all your fishing and bonding time was well sacrificed to cutting all your wood, has easily paid itself off. Clean, free biofuel, keeping you, your family, and many homes around the world warm at little to no cost. Unlike fossil fuels, regaining the oil has become a bigger and bigger issue with countries around the world, leading to war and terrorism over the easily replaceable black gold.
You've been listening to a series of podcasts produced by students of the CARES program with the high schools here in town. Continue the last one on Friday. You are tuned to KTUO in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201AM 88.1. K220BT Sarsuna at 91.9. In Excursion Inland and Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210AS at 89.9. We're also live online at www.ktoo.org. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock on a June afternoon, Pat Moore will be your host. He'll talk with Sandy Fortier and Todd Hunt about this Sunday's Opera Spotlight. We'll talk with Kim Winicky about this year's Island Arts and Music Festival. Richie Adan will be here to highlight this weekend's June Dance Unlimited Spring Concert. And Nancy DeTrini will be here to give us a rundown on art happenings in the capital city during Arts House. Arts Up. Coming up next is All Things Considered. With the forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with scattered rain showers in the evening, low temperatures around 44 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, decreasing clouds with high temperatures around 60 degrees. Thursday night, partly cloudy skies with high temperatures, or low temperatures around 44 degrees. Friday, mostly cloudy skies with isolated showers in the afternoon. Thank you for tuning in to June Afternoon today, and have a pleasant evening. Coming up next is All Things Considered.
It means hope, and it means that the sacrifices that were done throughout this revolution is not gone without a fruit.
Egyptians cast their votes on the first day of free and democratic elections.
For Wednesday, May 23rd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.